Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that me and my running mate, Angela Walker, ran on in 2020. So the news this week is still what we talked about last week, the war on Gaza. Israel has escalated. It's really a humanitarian disaster, not just people dying from the bombing, but now diseases spreading. They don't have food, water, electricity. They're being pushed into further and further south. Seems like it might be part of an Israeli plan to push them out of Gaza into Egypt. And it's reverberating here. I mean, last week, I think, when we met there, we knew about that Burlington shooting of three Palestinian students who were visiting a family up there for Thanksgiving. And now we know who the shooter was. He's actually somebody from here in Syracuse, New York. And I knew this guy 10 or 15 years ago. He was not a right winger. He was kind of around the environmental movement and the community movement. And even, you know, periphery of the Green Party, he was kind of on his own. He was always advocating social investments. He was a financial advisor. He really wasn't, he was kind of socially maladroit. He really wasn't part of these movements, but he was around them. And what we know from reporting here in Syracuse is that when he moved up to Burlington recently, he'd been through a lot of jobs, but during the COVID lockdown, he went down that, rabbit hole of conspiracy theories about COVID origins and vaccines and maybe other, conspiracy rabbit holes, and came out the other end, and he shot these guys. And then we had this Albany shooting of a shotgun, two shots at a synagogue in Albany by an Iraqi American whose father says he's mentally disturbed. But what he told the officers that arrested him was that he did it to free Palestine. So the people on the margins are coming out in dangerous ways because this is such an emotional issue. And, that's minor compared to what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. I mean, we got to realize that the settlers are using the war in Gaza and the Hamas atrocities on October 7th as cover for attacking Palestinians and driving them out of their homes and villages on the West Bank. And something like 250 or 300 Palestinians have been killed on the West Bank during this period. So the situation is dire. So we got to keep demanding a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, and it should lead to a peace process for a political solution. And international pressure, particularly from the United States, is needed to get both sides moving toward a political solution. International law calls for a two-state solution. I've said that can leverage the opening of a peace process. It may not end up with a two-state solution. It might be a one-state solution or the hybrid confederation solution, but they need to be talking instead of shooting. And of course, you need reliable partners. The Netanyahu government is not. They don't want a Palestinian state, but he's in politically difficult straits, and if there were new elections, he'd be out and facing the corruption charges. And he seems to be using the war as a way to avoid that. He's not popular in Israel now, so Israel's going to have new elections, needs to have. And then, as I've said, the Palestinians need new elections. I've cited Mustafa Barghouti, who is director of the National Palestinian Initiative, who argues that both Hamas and Fatah are not popular with most Palestinians, and that you need new elections. And I would argue, and I did argue, for proportional representation so that everybody's represented in a new Palestinian National Council that would be a legitimate partner in negotiations in both the eyes of the Palestinians, which is most important, but then also important is the international community. And today I happened to catch an interview that Ali Velshi on his MSNBC program did with Hanan Ashrawi, who's a former PLO executive committee member and was a spokesperson for the Palestinian delegations when they were trying to negotiate the implementation of the two-state solution coming out of the Oslo peace process in the 1990s. Now, she left the PLO about 4 years ago, but what she said today, and I looked this up, she said it a month ago in a previous interview with Ali Velshi, is that they need free and fair elections for the Palestinians. And, you know, the Americans have blocked those elections. She pointed that out, which I've also pointed out, because they're afraid of who might win. They're worried about Hamas, but also probably people like Mustafa Barghouti, who's on the left. She said elections are part of the resistance. And in other words, that's how the Palestinians get themselves organized. She herself ran in the 2006 legislative elections for the Palestinian Authority. And she, you know, recounted how she was detained by Israeli authorities during her election campaign for a whole day. And that's just to speak to how it's hard for the Palestinians to even have an election without Israel interfering. And she also noted that, you know, there was a possibility at that time Hamas had accepted the two-state solution, maybe not as a permanent thing, but as a first step in their mind at that time. And the PLO, you know, long ago recognized Israel, but Israel has never recognized Palestine or the Palestinian Authority. And what we have now is Israel's trying to expel or kill all the Palestinians. That's the policy of the Netanyahu government and his right-wing partners. So, you know, it's up to the U.S. and the West in particular to stop Israel's assaults and begin to enforce international law. I mean, just yesterday, the U.S. vetoed a resolution for an immediate ceasefire that the Secretary General of the U.N. Called for. And, you know, some of the reporting, and I saw this in Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper today, saying that Israeli leaders like Netanyahu are worried that next time the U.S. may not veto, which would be a real change. So I think that's saying that all the protests that we've been doing here and around the world, you know, the U.S. government's hearing that because they are losing all diplomatic leverage or positive relations around the world because of their support for Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. So, you know, that's to say we got to keep up the pressure. You know, write your members of Congress, write them again if you already wrote once. Write to Biden, get out on the streets for these demonstrations. And I think, you know, we're making a difference and we've got to. So the other big thing going on this week is COP28, the UN's climate summit. And the U.S. is blocking a full commitment to full fossil fuel phase out, which is the big debate now in the last few days of COP28. And what John Kerry, Biden's climate envoy, said this week is that the U.S. quote unquote largely supports a phase out, but wants to leave room for some fossil fuel burning with carbon capture and sequestration, which is a dubious technology, hasn't been proven to work. And what it does is keep the door open for burning fossil fuels. Kerry cited things like cement and steel making, which doesn't require fossil fuels. The industrial heat processes required for cement and steel making and some other industries can be done with clean green hydrogen. And Kerry must know that. But that's the U.S. pandering to the big oil interests. And then another big thing is OPEC sent out a letter absolutely opposing language in the, you know, what they say about fossil fuels, opposing phase out. And of course, that represents the petro states. But the protests, to the extent they've been able to have them in this, you know, cordoned off area, have been for that phase out, complete phase out of fossil fuels, commitments by the countries to phase them out within a time certain, and also for a ceasefire in Gaza. And they're linking, they're saying you can't have climate change without recognizing human rights, because, you know, the human right to survive is what's at stake in this whole climate change thing. But the petro states are a real obstacle, including the U.S. But, you know, another leader of a petro state, Vladimir Putin, went to the UAE while these COP28 talks are going on. But he didn't go there. He went to meet with the Gulf petro states. And Putin has long been a climate change denier. He wants to, he was, you know, cutting more deals to sell fossil fuels. And also on the sidelines, thousands of fossil fuel executives are making deals. And the host of this conference, COP28, is Sultan Al Jaber, who's the CEO of the United Arab Emirates Oil and Gas Corporation. And they just decided that the next COP 29 will be in the petro state of Azerbaijan. Now, Azerbaijan just ethnically cleansed over 100,000 Armenians out of Nagorno-Karabakh, which those Armenians called the Republic of Artsakh, which was autonomously governed by Armenians within the larger Azerbaijani state. And internationally, you know, they were recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but Azerbaijan wants the Armenians out. There's been ethnic conflict for them for a long time, but the Armenians have lived in this region of what is now Azerbaijan for 2,500 years, since the 7th century BC. And Russia had troops there to protect the Armenians, but for geopolitical reasons, they switched sides and they let the Azerbaijanis just push all those Armenians out of their homeland, you know, which is another case of occupation and colonialism that, you know, we need to be speaking about. They're more than just Ukraine and Palestine. You know, there's Western Sahara, there's West Papua, there's Kashmir. There's a whole lot of them that, you know, the imperialists of the world are still doing, and we've got to oppose them all. But you know, for what's coming out of COP 28 is a farce. You know, if Putin and the oil executives can be making oil deals on the sidelines right there in Doha while the COP 28 is going on, it just shows what a farce this process is. I'd like to draw your attention to another appeal from Svetlana Romanko, who we've had on this podcast. It was on Common Dreams yesterday, calling for tighter sanctions on Russian fossil fuels that are financing Russia's war in Ukraine. And also, I would add, a recent escalation of their bombing in Syria, in Idlib, in northwest Syria. We'll put a link to her op-ed from Common Dreams in the chat, and also a link, which her op-ed refers to Razum We Stand's latest report, that's Svetlana's organization, called The Carbon Wars, Accounting for the Proliferation of Russian Fossil Fuels. And the bottom line of that report is that Russia has received $600 billion in oil and gas revenues since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started. That's far more, multiples more, than the U.S. and the EU have provided Ukraine for its self-defense. And right now, Putin and Russian state propagandists are crowing about their friends in the neo-fascist Republican Party blocking U.S. aid to Ukraine. Ukraine's in a difficult situation. They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of funds to basically, you know, provide pensions and schools and healthcare to their people. And, you know, to just show you how much of a sieve these oil sanctions are that the West has imposed, most of the rest of the world hasn't gone along, but Saudi Arabia is buying Russian oil at low prices, which they then re-export, or can they export their own oil, at a much higher price. And it's going to places like the Pentagon, and probably all of us, because The Russians are burning oil sold on the general market, Saudi Arabia, but also oil they sell directly to Turkey and Greece, where refiners then there refine it and sell it as refined oil to the United States and other countries. And China, too, is selling European liquefied natural gas and that originated in Russia and Siberia. And they're also importing Russian oil and doing the same thing, refining it and then reselling it, exporting it at a higher price. So that's what Svetlana is talking about. She was thrown out of the last COP, COP 27 in Cairo, Egypt, because she confronted and disrupted the Russian delegation's presentation. And we'll put a link to her protest in the chat. I've done that before, but you know, take a look at it. She speaks up and gets thrown out. Another woman does. And then the last person removed in that protest, he's wearing a purple jacket, is Jason Kilpatrick, or Kirkpatrick, who was a Green City Councilor in Arcata, California, vice mayor when we had the first majority Green City Council in the United States. And Jason's now the communications director for Ramaco's Rosin We Stand organization. So what I would say about all this is the Green Party needs to be on the streets and in the elections opposing both genocide of Palestinians and genocide of humanity by climate change. And of course, we have many other issues, like how about healthcare, Medicare for all, preferably as a national health service, or a real Green New Deal, or taxing the rich, or cutting the military budget. These are not on the agenda of either the neoliberal Democrats or the neo-fascist Republicans. And that's why we need a Green Party. So I'll stop there. And, I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Beatty Dimmitt, is Russia developing the offshore oil fuel resources by Crimea? I don't think they're developing it right now because of they can't even keep their Black Sea naval forces patrolling the Crimea because Ukraine has been able to attack and sink some of their ships with drones and missiles. So they mostly move their naval force in the Black Sea over to Russian ports on the far side of the Black Sea, not in Crimea, not in Sevastopol, where they have a naval base. So I don't think they're developing those resources. And a lot of people say that's why Russia is in Crimea, or why NATO is supporting Ukraine. I don't think it's about the oil. I think in the case of Russia, it's about, you know, Putin and the Russian leadership's continuation of centuries old, you know, great Russian chauvinism. They have an imperialist mentality. They want to regain control over territories that the Russian Empire once held, the Soviet Union once held. And it's also about Russian domestic politics. Putin needs that war to divert people from all the problems inside the country. Tremendous poverty and economic inequality, corruption, and the kind of things that led to mass demonstrations against election rigging around 2011, 2012, again in 2019, and also the protests led by Navalny against both corruption and phony elections. So, there's a lot of domestic dissent. It's hard because of the high degree of repression. I mean, there are now 20,000 people in prison because they protested the war in Ukraine in the mildest of ways. Some people held up blank signs publicly. And just, doing that got them arrested and, accused of the crime of discrediting the Russian armed forces. So, the oil and gas is there in the Black Sea. But I don't think that's the big reason why either side is engaged in this conflict. Beatty Dimmitt. Is the news paying attention to the flooding of the COP sessions with fossil fuel lobbyists? Democracy Now! Has given it some serious noise and annoyance and covered the closest thing allowed to Gaza-Israel protests there. It depends. It's not a leading issue in the mass media. But if you go to publications that are serious, like, you know, The Guardian out of the UK or Al Jazeera or Washington Post, you'll find stories about it. But it's not something that's leading. And, you know, that's the problem. Democracy Now! Has given it, has highlighted it, and I applaud them for that. Scout Trooper 164, the fact that the Republicans are refusing to give aid until the border is resolved is both understandable and effing dumb, especially with Lindsey Graham having an arrest warrant from Russia. I didn't know about that arrest warrant, but Lindsey Graham is a dummy. I mean, I think, you know, just tune out what he says or laugh at it. But the Republicans, yeah, they... you know, and some of them, they don't want to give aid to Ukraine. Most of them do at this point. Probably a narrow majority of Republicans plus almost all the Democrats means that if they ever get to a vote, if it was a straight up vote on aid to Ukraine, it would pass in the House and the Senate. And of course, Biden would sign it. Linked to Israeli aid, then it becomes a problem for some of the people that want to stop this war and want to stop giving aid to Israel. And then the border reforms that the Republicans are advocating are just inhumane and cruel. And, you know, so, but the problem is the Democrats don't take those things head on. Biden right now is going to give ground on the border policies, on the immigration policies in order to get support for the aid to Ukraine and Israel. So, it, you know, if I was in the House and voting or the Senate and voting on this, I mean, I'd probably vote for it because Ukraine needs it for its survival. And Israel has enough weapons that, you know, if the U.S. sends them more, it's like, you know, bouncing the rubble. And the border policy is terrible. It's a tough choice. But, you know, to deny the Ukrainians aid as they're running out of ammunition and as they're running out of money is just, you know, Russia's just going to roll right over the Ukrainians if they can't fight back. So that's a tough question. And what's going on? And, you know, it's a result of this two-party system where the Republicans are intransigent, they're right wing, and the neoliberal Democrats, instead of, you know, fighting them, discrediting them, defeating them, are trying to compromise with them. I mean, Biden's still talking about we need bipartisan solutions with the party that tried to overthrow his election. So we just have a terrible situation in Congress. And, you know, what we got to be doing is, you know, protesting, writing letters, writing op-eds, and, you know, trying to, you know, lay the basis for a new Congress at some point that is, you know, really promoting human rights around the world and meeting the people's needs at home. And we're far from that right now. And the Republicans, you know, they don't care about anybody or really doing anything. They particularly their right wing seems to just revel in saying outrageous things and getting covered in the media for being outrageous. Andrew Hager, speaking of fossil fuels, Howie, what is your honest opinion on replacing fossil fuels for more renewable, eco-friendly ones, like biodiesel, hydrogen, recycled cooking oil? Well, I'm very optimistic. The technology is there, and it's not biodiesel and recycled cooking oil. It's solar and wind. And hydrogen as an energy storage system for limited uses, which is long-distance trucking and shipping and possibly air travel. And for industrial heat processes that require high heat, like cement and steel making and chemicals, food processing. But hydrogen is the most expensive energy storage system among the clean renewable options. You know, compressed air, stored water in a in a dam where it's pumped into the dam and then comes down to spin a generator to produce electricity. Batteries are getting cheaper and more greater capacity. So hydrogen is more expensive than those things, but it's the only solution for the things I mentioned, high heat industrial processes and long distance transportation. So yeah, the technology's there. Mark Jacobson, if you read his stuff, you know, lays it out, you know, across the whole board, including the limited role that green hydrogen should play. And I always refer to him when I'm thinking about these technological questions of renewable energy. So that's my honest opinion. I mean, it's not a problem of technology. It's a problem of political will. And I would add that if we had the political will, it would have to be an eco-socialist solution. We've got to have public ownership of the big energy companies, the oil and gas industry, the big transportation companies, or at least a public transportation company to build out our rail systems and our mass transit systems, and some of the big industries that rely on high heat industrial processes like steel making. Those industries are not going to mothball their coke ovens to make steel to replace them with hydrogen and electric arc furnaces without them being in the public sector, where we just, you know, stop using coke ovens and start building the alternatives that are clean because it's not in their profit interest. So, and you've got to have a major part of these industries under public ownership so we can plan the complicated interconnected transition to 100% clean energy and zero emissions and really going toward negative emissions. And that can't be done just by the government, you know, providing subsidies and incentives to these corporations that have created the climate crisis in the first place. So, it's not just political will. It's a certain kind of political will. It's an eco-socialist political will that we need. And again, that's why we need the Green Party, because Democrats, and I could go into chapter and verse now, but I won't. I think I did a little bit last week, like on the clean energy stuff we've done here in New York State. The Democrats won't take on the corporations and instead just want to offer them subsidies, which is hit or miss. We have a problem now that offshore wind isn't being built because the borrowing they need to do with high interest rates makes it not as profitable as it was before, even with the subsidies the federal government's offering. And that's the problem when you try to make this decision or this transition using profit motive and public incentives rather than a public system where you set the objectives and you make the investments you need to make the transition and make sure they're coordinated. You know, if you're going to build out a rapid transit system in all the cities, that's a good opportunity to make walkable communities and do that with public housing near the hubs of this transit system. So that needs to be coordinated. It's not the private industry and the market is just not going to do that. So that's why I say we need an eco-socialist political will to implement these technologies for a clean energy system that are already here. With recent progress in producing hydrogen from marine water, the use of hydrogen on a major scale could be used to also replenish freshwater aquifers, couldn't it? Yeah, you brought that up before. Massive stationary hydrogen burning facilities is what I'm talking about, and catching the water formed by the burning. Yeah, I believe you brought that up, or somebody did before, and I looked up what they're talking about, and I'm trying to remember, they came up with a way of getting the sodium and other impurities out of the water from seawater in a much cheaper way than before, which makes it more cost effective and energy efficient to do this kind of production of hydrogen from seawater. But like I said, until it doesn't look like anytime soon, hydrogen is going to be cheaper than these other energy storage systems, storing renewable energy, renewable electricity, or energy, so it can be turned into electricity. Hydrogen should be limited to those uses where it's really the only solution that is clean, long distance transportation and industrial high heat processes. B.D. Dimmitt, shouldn't a positive solution in Gaza involve flooding the region with renewable energy tech to make the offshore gas fields less of an issue? Again, I think the focus on, you know, maybe Israel wanting to clean out Gaza so they can go after the oil, I think that's less of a factor than, you know, Zionist ideology, that they have a biblical religious right to all of Palestine, and the Palestinians are in the way of that biblical injunction. I mean, that's what you're getting from the right-wing religious part of the coalition behind Netanyahu, who himself, you know, has been for, you know, against the Palestinian state and just keeping the Palestinians oppressed or expelled. I think that's just a bigger factor. The oil, offshore oil and gas is, you know, a factor. You know, everybody, you know, wants to make money off that. And of course, that's not what we want. We want to leave it where it is and replace them with renewable energy. And I think not just in Israel, Palestine and Gaza, but throughout the world, you know, the Eco-Socialist Green New Deal should be a global Green New Deal. We should be putting, you know, I've said 75% of our military budget should be cut, and it should be reinvested in a global Green New Deal. Let's help the world develop. Let's make friends instead of enemies. Let's be the world's humanitarian superpower instead of its military superpower. And, in, you know, that will win us friends around the world. It will build peace. It's what's needed, and is needed in Gaza and Israel, Palestine, but it's needed all over the world. And the U.S. has the wealth and the technology and the know-how to make this happen. And instead of sending the military everybody everywhere, we should be sending renewable energy everywhere. Which brings up another issue at COP. They finally agreed on the first day of this thing to a loss and damage fund to you know, pay for the damages done by climate change, particularly in the poorer countries in the global south. But how is it going to be funded? I think the U.S. committed $17.5 million when it needs billions. Yeah, I think what they said, it needs $1 billion a year. And they've got pledges. I gave you the numbers last week, but it's far short. So it's talk, but not the action that we need. And so, you know, like I said, we should be putting most of the money we're putting into the military into a global Green New Deal and build peace and friendship instead of enemies and war. Dems already think they're the humanitarian superpower. Laugh out loud. Biden getting in the way of the ceasefire is Dems at their most quote unquote humanitarian. Yeah, they always put that, you know, humanitarian cover on aggression. They say they're defending Israel and ignore that they're killing Palestinians. Putin does the same thing. He's intervening in Ukraine to protect or to stop the quote, the so-called genocide of Russian speakers in Ukraine, which never happened. You know, Hitler went into Sudetenland to protect the Germans in Czechoslovakia. I mean, imperialists always have a humanitarian excuse. That doesn't mean humanitarianism is wrong. It means it's wrong to use as a cover for aggression and war and imperialism. So, yeah, the Democrats are, you know, the hypocrisy of, you know, getting all self-righteous about Ukraine, but then supporting aggression. And I'll just list some of them. We provide military aid to Morocco to keep Western Sahara colonized. We provide military aid to Indonesia that keeps West Papua colonized. And that's something people don't know enough about. There are the indigenous people are fighting off highly weapon, you know, sophisticated weapons of the Indonesian army with bows and arrows in most cases in their insurgency. They voted for independence back in the early 60s, and Indonesia just annexed them. Holland had had them before, or the Netherlands, I guess that's the same thing. Where else? Kashmir, where the Indians in particular, but also the Pakistanians are you know, occupying Kashmir, which wants independence and autonomy. I mentioned what happened to the Armenians in Azerbaijan. In that case, you know, Russia was the power there that had the military aid, and they switched sides and let the Azerbaijanis throw 100,000 Armenians out of a place they've lived since the 7th century BC. So there are a lot of these situations, and the Democrats get all self-righteous about Ukraine, and then Israel ignoring what it's doing to Palestine and ignoring all these other cases. I'll mention one more. The military aid we provide to the Rwandan regime, which backs the M23 militia and sometimes sends its own forces into the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where there's a civil war going on for who will control those mineral resources, a lot of which are rare earth minerals needed for renewable energy. And you know, where are the Democrats on that? 6 million people have died in that civil war over the last 30 years, and hardly anybody knows about it. So yeah, the Democrats' hypocrisy stinks to high heaven, no doubt. Scout Trooper 164, why do I not feel not surprised? We can't do more than we have, mostly old farts who are greedy and still reluctant to move on from the Cold War. Yeah, and you know, the another part of this is the corporate interests that fund these people to get into office. And they have interests in these various regions of the world where we send the US military to make the world safe for US-based multinational corporations. And that is a lot of what motivates our involvement around the world. It's a economic empire backed by military force, not a traditional or 19th century style colonial empire where we claim the, you know, sovereignty over the land. But the impact on the indigenous people in these countries and the extraction of wealth from these countries and the impoverishment of those countries is, you know, similar to what was going on in the 19th century. And before that, in the case of Africa, you know, for four centuries before that with the slave trade. Via email, did you watch the latest GOP debate? No, I had more important things to do than watch a comedy show. And I've, you know, heard some little snippets about it, but I didn't, because I don't think they have anything relevant in terms of policy or anything I would learn from them. The commentary I have seen says it's a debate to see who's going to be the second place finisher to Trump. And maybe that lays the basis for a future campaign or being the vice presidential candidate. I guess they all say they'll support Trump if he's a nominee, except Chris Christie. I didn't watch it. I don't know if I missed something I should have, but I didn't watch it. Via email, comments on the gag order fights in multiple Trump trials. The judges are trying to protect the integrity of the judicial process in court. So when Trump attacks court officials or says things that may, bias the jury pool, those are legitimate issues. I haven't looked at the details. I guess what happened was one court backed up a judge's quick gag order, and then on appeal, they limited the gag order some. I haven't followed it at that detail. But I think, you know, the gag orders are legitimate in terms of protecting the integrity of the judicial process. B.D. Dimmitt, since Dr. Stein's last POTUS run, Amy Goodman and company seem to have little inclination to go any further to the left than Democrats do, despite her participation in Stein's effort to offer some semblance of a debate response. And I think that was 2012, not 2016. Maybe I'm wrong. And perhaps the camaraderie of having each earned an arrest warrant over Standing Rock support. Democracy Now! Went through the intervening years in seeming support for the mythos that AOC came up with the Green New Deal. Now broadcasting from Dubai and the COP sessions. I see a dot, dot, dot. Is there a second part to that? Well, yeah, I think Amy Goodman is pandering to our audience to some extent, because the dominant theme on the progressive side of the political spectrum since Trump won the 2016 election is that the Democrats got to be supported. That's why I didn't get a second of FaceTime with Democracy Now! When I ran in 2020. The only coverage was when we hired a Republican lawyer in our ballot access fight in Wisconsin, who we hired because we couldn't get any Democrats or progressives. They all ran from us. And she, you know, put out, it was just a little news report, but it cast a negative light on us. And it was at the same time that Rachel Maddow on her show on MSNBC said that we were a Republican op. And, you know, just repeating Clintonite talking points about the Greens. So now I believe Amy Goodman did have Cornel West on, and I would not be surprised if she doesn't have Jill Stein on, because the dynamic is very different this time. There's so much discuss with Genocide Joe, particularly after what's happened in Gaza, but also before. I mean, the Democrats had both houses. They couldn't get the Voting Rights Act restoration passed. They couldn't get the labor law reform, the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize bill, passed. They couldn't get the codification of Roe v. Wade to protect abortion rights passed, all because they wouldn't go after the filibuster. And, you know, Biden was in the lead on that. So there's been a lot of disillusionment. And that's why I think there's so much interest. The polls are showing it in candidates' alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. I mean, Robert Kennedy gets a lot of support just because he's not a Democrat or Republican. I think as people find out more where he stands on issues like Israel or vaccines, he's going to lose a lot of support. He's kind of out there on the margins of reality. Cornel West and Jill Stein, I think, you know, they're legitimate progressive alternatives. And as I think I may have said here before, Jill's open to bringing Cornel back in onto the ticket, because he's not going to get on a ballot. He doesn't have the money to do all the petitioning he needs to do. And when he finds that out, maybe he'll be willing to come back to the green ticket. And, you know, a Stein-West ticket would certainly get a lot of attention. And I think not just from the voting public, but from the media, the mass media and the progressive media like Democracy Now! Very different dynamic than in 2020, when anybody but Trump. You know, the only time I got covered is when some progressive group wrote an open letter telling people why they should vote for Biden and not me. That was a very tough year, just given the overall dynamic. It's different this time. So I'm hopeful that Democracy Now! Will cover Jill Stein's campaign this time. And if they don't, shame on them. But I think I'm hopeful they will. Scout Trooper 164, a Russian general has stated in an interview that they'll end the war if they can keep the cities of Ukraine that contain hundreds of thousands. That's not fair to these citizens. Yeah, that's like Netanyahu saying they'll end the war when they take all the land where the Palestinians are densely populated, and you know, let a few Bedouins live in the desert is you know, basically what the general's saying about Ukraine. Yeah, the people, you know, including, you know, progressive peace groups like Cold Pink, who think if we get a ceasefire and negotiations, the Russians are going to stop. What they say is, let's cut off arms to Ukraine and then we'll get to a ceasefire and negotiations. If arms are cut off to Ukraine, the Russians will see their opportunity to seize more land. And, you know, if you follow what's said on Russian state media by their propagandists and their equivalents of Tucker Carlson, you know, riling up the people for militarism, or Putin himself, or Foreign Minister Lavrov, or, you know, the deputy head of the Security Council, the former president, Dmitry Medvedev, you know, they are all about taking more Ukrainian land. They don't control all of the four oblasts that they claim to have annexed about a year ago, about 15 months ago. So they're still fighting for that at least, but you follow what they say. They want to get Odessa and Mykolaiv so they can get a land bridge, not just to Crimea, but all the way to Moldova, where they have occupied a slice of Moldova since the early 1990s. You know, cutting off arms to Ukraine is not going to lead to a ceasefire. And, you know, the Russian general saying, you know, we'll stop the war when we've conquered the cities where the Ukrainians live is tells you where they're really coming from. B.D. Dimmitt, if a green POTUS run this cycle should break the 5% tape, RFK's campaign would make the benefits more significant, wouldn't it? If you get over 5%, what that does is give you a proportionate share of the full public campaign financing for the next general election. So if you get over 25%, you get the full share, which was about $100 million. That you would get just after Labor Day and spend between then and the general election. And the major parties have stopped taking this. The last one to take it was McCain when he was running against Obama. Since then, so much money has poured into these presidential campaigns. $100 million is nothing. But for us, it would be huge, or a prorated share of that. So, you know, 5% would be a fifth of 25%. So that would be at least $20 million for the Green presidential campaign in 2028 to run on the last 2 months of the campaign. You know, that would be amazing. Now, if Kennedy, you know, got over 5%, he would get an amount based on the same prorating between 5% and 25%. It wouldn't affect what the Greens got. So I don't think it would make the benefits more significant. But, you know, if we got to that point, it would be significant. And that's, I just want to emphasize, people get, you know, very hopeful about that. It's very difficult. When we ran Ralph Nader in 2000, he was a household name. He was America's consumer advocate. His favorability ratings were through the roof. And yet, running against Gore, who was kind of a wooden, you know, candidate trying to run on Clinton politics, which were unpopular until the end, he kind of went populist and caught up with Bush. And George Bush, who was ignorant and inarticulate and, you know, made more gaffes than Joe Biden, you know, but he branded himself as a compassionate conservative. That was a good year. It was an open seat. We had a great candidate, and Ralph still only got 2.74%. he got less media coverage than Cornel West has got so far this time from the mass media. It was just criminal what they did. So that's just to show how difficult it is. You know, Jill Stein, you know, for all her positive aspects, is not Ralph Nader in terms of name recognition and favorability ratings. Jill has been beaten up by, you know, the Clinton smear that she's a Russian asset and other things. So she's even got a harder row to hoe than Nader did in 2000. On the other hand, the disaffection from the two major parties now is at a record level. Gallup has been tracking this for years. Their last poll showed 63% of Americans want an alternative to the two major parties. They want a third major party. And that shows, and I think it's shown up in the polls where, you know, before Jill got in, you know, Cornel West is getting as high as 8%, normally 4%, 3%. Now, Jill, they're both getting 3% in the most recent polls, but that's 6% combined, 6% combined if they could hold that. But the problem is, as we get closer to the general election, the spoiler problem becomes stronger and stronger. And a lot of progressive-minded people who like the Greens much more than they do the Democrats are going to feel they have to vote for the Democrats to stop the fascist Republicans. And that dynamic is not so strong right now because it's still a year away, but I'm afraid it will become very strong, which is all to say that don't underestimate how hard 5% is to get in, you know, given our current electoral system. I think one thing I hope Jill will emphasize, I've urged her to, also I urge Cornel West to, is when you get the spoiler question, or even when you don't get it, bring it up and say, we got a solution to the spoiler problem. It's a ranked choice vote for president, national popular vote. And if Biden won't support that, he's creating the spoiler problem, not us. And I think, you know, that's an issue given the concern about democracy, concern about the limited choices in the two-party system, is a reform, ranked choice voting for the presidential race that could gain traction and should be pushed by our campaign, you know, our Green presidential campaign, in the mass media at every opportunity. And then our candidates for federal office, House and Senate, should be raising it. Our candidates for the state legislatures should be raising it for their states and for local offices, for their city and town councils. So I think that is an issue whose time has come and we really need to push it in this election cycle. Violent at Content Boutique. What do we need to do to get ranked choice voting on the national ballot? Well, we can't do it because we don't have national initiative and referendum. But we can do it by getting it into the presidential race and making a vote for the presidential candidate, a vote of who's supporting and who's not. Now, I think that's how we get on the national ballot, which our presidential candidate in particular can do, but so can our federal candidates for the House and Senate. And it's really something that, you know, we can all contribute to, even if we're not candidates, by letters to the editor, op-eds. In many states, you know, this will be on the ballot. Oregon, it'll be on the ballot. Nevada, it will be on the ballot. There are other states where petitioning is going on right now. And so it will become an election issue in many states next year. And that's where, you know, we can have an impact by speaking up and supporting these initiatives. Now, I will say a problem with a lot of these initiatives is that they set up a jungle primary that's plurality winner. And the top four vote getters then move on to a ranked choice vote in the general election. The problem with that is it takes away the nomination process from parties instead of a partisan primaries, where the members of each party get to pick their nominee. You have a nonpartisan primary where people with money, they can grab any label they want, you know, and the party can't do anything about it. You can get a phony Green, you know, with lots of money and say they're the Green candidate, spend a lot of money, and Green voters will think, oh, that's our candidate, when the actual Green Party organization in that state said, no, you know, this other person is our candidate. But we don't have the resources that some of these multimillionaires and billionaires have to promote themselves. That's the problem with the top four, combined with ranked choice voting. So I've been planning to write an op-ed, ranked choice voting, yes, top four, no. And hopefully I'll get to that pretty soon. But unfortunately, these propositions, because there's a lot of money behind these nonpartisan primaries, because they do destroy parties. And the left, if it's going to be significant, has to be organized and have principles and hopefully do so it's got resources and it has a membership, not just voluntary donations that, every level of the party is competing with the other levels and every candidate running for office, they're all asking for donations. It would be much better if we just paid dues to the national, we shared it with the states and locals. And then, the candidates would still be raising their own money, but there wouldn't be as much competition for the Green Party money. And that's why, I've called for a mass membership party, which has been the traditional form that left parties have taken. That's the way they can be organized and financed to compete with the top-down parties funded by elites, which is what we've got with the Democrats and Republicans, is what conservative parties in Europe have traditionally been. And unfortunately, the Green Party adopted that model for its structure. And so that's a reform of the Green Party, I'd like to see. But a lot of state parties have adopted that. I believe the Young Eco-Socialists have adopted that as well. To be a member, you need to pay dues. Chris knows. He's in the background right now. He'll correct me on that if I'm wrong, but I think that's the case. So it's an idea that's spreading within the Green Party, and hopefully we'll take it to the national level at some point soon. Yes, the Youth Caucus is dues-based. Thank you for confirming that, Chris. So the idea is spreading within the Green Party. There are state parties like Wisconsin and I believe Pennsylvania, North Carolina, that have that. It's the New York party is kind of a hybrid. You get extra delegates if you get Illinois. There's another state party with that. So I think we're learning from our mistakes that's the model we need, at least in a number of the states. We need critical thinking. Is proportional voting better than ranked choice voting? Yeah, proportional representation for legislative bodies is better than ranked choice voting for single member districts. You can have proportional ranked choice voting by having multi-member districts where you rank your choices and the people elected are elected in proportion to the votes each party's candidates get. There are other ways of doing proportional representation. There are party list systems where you vote for the party and there's a list of the candidates that are on the party list. That's common in many countries. You can have a system where you can, pick candidates from different parties and rank them. The system I like the best, but I think it'd be hard to implement in the United States because we have too many state jurisdictions, is what they call mixed member proportional representation. This is what they use in Germany. It's what they use in New Zealand. So they have district elections for half the seats of the legislature, and then they have a party list. And the party list vote determines the proportion each party should get. So if your party doesn't win district elections because they're a minor party, but wins, say, 15% of the party list vote, there will be candidates on the party list added to those elected to the legislature. So you get overall proportionality, but you also get district representatives who can focus on your district's concerns. And ideally, and I don't know anybody who's done this yet, those district elections should be ranked choice voting. So I'm going into a lot, I'm going into the weeds on that, but basically proportional voting can be used as ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. So they're not counterposed. What we're really talking about is ranked choice voting for executive offices, which are single seats, and proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. So they're both ranked choice voting, but in the legislative bodies, you end up with proportional representation. And I would recommend going to fairvote.org if you want to understand how these different systems work. They have a lot of good material there and clear explanations. National RCV is a pipeline without representation, especially during the ramping up of the global Fourth Reich. A pipe dream makes it sound like it's impossible, or we can't, you know, get there without a lot of representation in Congress that could introduce legislation to establish a national popular ranked choice vote. But some issues get adopted without the people advocating them initially being elected to Congress. We've seen that with many issues. I mean, an example is the Green New Deal, which the Greens made their signature issue in the 2010s. And the progressive Democrats picked it up, albeit they watered it down, but it became a term of debate. The socialists for years pushed a lot of the reforms that the Rooseveltian New Deal adopted concerning labor organizing rights, protection of child labor, Social Security, as you know, old age pensions. So we don't have to win the office to have an influence, although it'd be better if we did have people in office. And given that, you know, the polls I was citing, you know, the Gallup poll, 63% of the people want an alternative to the Democrats and Republicans. So we should be campaigning for an inclusive multi-party democracy made possible by ranked choice voting and proportional representation in the Congress. And I think people are ready for that. We've had 27 straight wins on ranked choice voting in local and state elections over the last few years. And as I said, it's on the ballot in several states in 2024. We won all our, I think it was on 5 or 7 ballots in local elections in 2023. We won them all. Two of them were defeating, I think it was 7, and two of them were defeating efforts by opponents of ranked choice voting to have it repealed. And they lost, we won. So, you know, civil rights was a long shot. You know, if you're coming out of World War II and segregation is, you know, institutionalized, but we got there, at least on paper. So I'm not as pessimistic. Happy birthday. Thank you. It was yesterday. I appreciate that. And my email is crowded with that. I guess Facebook tells people. So I get these emails. I haven't looked at Facebook. It's probably full of that stuff too. But I appreciate it. Thank you. Wow. I looked at the clock 20 minutes ago. It seemed like 1 minute ago. Well, you know, like I said at the beginning, we got to step up and be active. We're not getting help at COP28 on the climate crisis. We're not getting help. Or we've got this, you know, disaster going on in Gaza and Israel, Palestine. We're not getting help from the Democrats, although I think we're beginning to push them a little bit. And I guess I'm just exhorting you to get out there. Don't be discouraged. We do make a difference. We don't even have to win office to make a difference. I've often pointed out that after I got 5% of the vote against Andrew Cuomo in 2014, and he wanted to run up the vote, get more than his daddy ever got more than he got in 2010, and he got less. He had to take account of that 5% of the vote we got. And he made some changes. We got the $15 minimum wage. We got a ban on fracking. We got paid family leave. Not exactly as we wanted it. We would have had stronger implementation of those programs, but he had to move because he had to compete with our vote. He couldn't take it for granted. So, you know, we often are winning the day when we don't even realize it. Dave Dellinger, who was a prominent anti-war activist in the 60s, he was one of the Chicago 8 They call him the Chicago Seven, but they always forget Bobby Seale, whose trial was separated. You know, he wrote a book called More Power Than We Know about 1974. You can probably still find it, a used version online. And he talks about how, you know, a lot of the, you know, student radicals, you know, they went into crazy things like weatherman, and they just gave up on the American people, when in fact, we'd already won the people over to an anti-war position. And we know from subsequent research by, you know, journalists, including Seymour Hersh and his book about Kissinger, that Nixon and Kissinger realized that they couldn't use their secret plan to end the war in Vietnam, which was tactical nuclear weapons, or at least intimidating North Vietnam into capitulating. And they thought if they did, they'd have a revolution in this country, because the anti-war movement was so broad and popular. And they weren't looking at, you know, fringe activities like weatherman. They were looking at the Vietnam moratorium in 1969, where millions of people went out in October and again a month later in November, and just showed that the masses of people had it with this war in Vietnam and wanted to get out. And what I'm saying is, we had won the day. Even a Republican administration with Henry Kissinger as the advisor, a war criminal, because politically they realized they couldn't go forward. And we didn't even know it at the time. I mean, I was drafted in that period, and I thought after Nixon gets reelected, we're going to re-escalate in Vietnam. But I didn't realize how much of an impact we had had. So that's all to say, don't get discouraged. We are winning people over. We know from public opinion polls that our positions on major issues like healthcare, Medicare for all, have super majorities. Green New Deal is popular. People want to tax the rich. They want to cut back on our foreign military commitments. There's so much, and that's why the Democrats try to knock us off the ballot, because they know our positions are more popular than theirs. So that's just to encourage you all to stay active and don't be discouraged. So we'll be here next week, and we'll go into the issues again. Have a good week.